It's dark on Observatory Hill. Come on, let's pretend we're Jack and Jill. We'll stroll to the hilltop where college sweethearts go to look at the lights on the campus down below. We'll learn what astronomy is for, and we'll learn what the stars can have in store. I know in advance that the moon may mean romance when it's dark on Observatory Hill.
Oh, and boy. Bob Crosby singing When It's Dark on Observatory Hill, which was a very popular song back in the 1930s, and it had to do with what was going on at the kind of below the Washburn Observatory on Observatory Hill on the UW-Madison campus. And we'll get some backstory on that as we move along today, but we thought it'd be a great way to start as we visit with the co-authors of the new book, Chasing the Stars. And it tells the century-long history of the Washburn Observatory and the work of astronomers on the UW-Madison campus. Great to have Jim Lattice with us, director of the UW Space Place, one of the authors. He's also a faculty associate in astronomy with the UW College of Letters and Sciences. Been with us many a time, but this is the first time to talk about your book. Jim, welcome.
Thank you very much, Larry. It's great to be here.
The other author is Kelly Tyrell. Kelly is a science writer. She is also director of media relations and strategic communications at UW-Madison, and the other author. And Kelly, welcome.
Thank you so much, Larry. We're both excited to be here talking about our book.
Well, it's great to have you here. And as we visit with the two authors, I hope you'll join in. Questions you have about the maybe the UW Observatory, maybe about the universe, maybe about using telescopes, and maybe your grandma or your grandpa, well, maybe you two were involved at the Washburn Observatory at one time in your life, and we'd love to hear your comments about what you might have done while you were there. Easy to join in. You can call us. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, Kelly, one day I sat down on my porch, my front porch, with a copy of your book, and I sat down with a cup of coffee or two, and it was a wonderful day. The sky was bright and shining, and I loved that day. It was so much fun to sit out on the porch and read this fascinating book, Chasing the Stars. You say it's not a scholarly history of Wisconsin astronomy. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so Jim and I have known each other for probably about a decade now. And we met here at the university. I started in 2014 as a science writer, and my job has been to help make the science that happens on our campus accessible for people who aren't already experts in the kinds of really exciting research projects that go on here. And Jim and I had started working together around some of the more public astronomy events that happen in the world, meteors and other things that people get excited about in the nighttime sky. And we had a really good partnership working together, taking the historical knowledge that Jim holds around astronomy and my experience publicly communicating about that science. And we had this idea to write a book that would help bring the history of Washburn Observatory to the present day and really make it vibrant and exciting for people who are maybe already very familiar with Washburn because they visited before, and then maybe others who don't realize the really important connections that our university, that many of us have visited or excited to know, has the important work that it really has brought us into sort of the current moment in astronomy and astrophysics.
Well, it really is a fun and fascinating story. And it just maybe let's go right back to the building of it, Jim Lattice. Built in 1881, if I'm not mistaken. And it was the first privately funded building on the UW-Madison campus. And we had a we had a guy with a lot of money.
That's right, and it's named after him. It's not named after an astronomer. It's named after the guy who had the money. Right, that was Governor Cadwallader Washburn. And Washburn wanted to make a major gift to the university. And he didn't have an astronomical background. In fact, he didn't have much formal education. He was sort of a frontiersman who moved to Wisconsin to seek his fortune in what eventually became heavy industry and lumbering and milling and things like that.
Land acquisition. Yeah,
land agent was how he got started. That's right, yeah. So, which was an exciting life in those days. But Washburn, when he decided to retire from politics and had a large fortune to dispose of, wanted to make a gift to the university. And the that was right at the height of what historians will call the observatory movement in the United States, the American observatory movement. And John Bascom was really important in this, in that he saw the University of Wisconsin. He wanted the University of Wisconsin to move in the direction of what we now call a research university. It was a new pattern in those days for universities, something that was being copied from European models at places like Harvard and MIT and Michigan. And Bascom thought that Wisconsin ought to join that movement. But you need research institutions to be a research university, and those had to be built. So Washburn volunteered to build our first research institution, which was Washburn Observatory. And that was completed in 1881. Yeah, between 1878 and 1881.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. And frankly, the observatory, an effigy mound was destroyed when the Washburn Observatory was constructed. But yeah, interesting to me, that first chapter, I really enjoyed that first chapter, which was kind of a history of how effigy mounds built by Wisconsin Indians started way back when. Tell us a little about that.
Sure, Larry. I think it is notable that the observatory is built on a former effigy mound, and the second director, Edward Holden, actually acknowledged this publicly.
Yeah.
And seemed to lament the fact that the observatory was built on such a site. But Jim and I thought it was really important to begin our book with a chapter on the early stargazers of the upper Midwest and in Wisconsin. I think we often focus on what we understand through the lens of Western science, and it was important to us to acknowledge that indigenous peoples were scientists in their own right and remain scientists in their own right. And we really wanted to bring that through line of sort of the original people here up through the present day. And so the book really does begin with the mound builders and the connections between early indigenous people who settled here around 200 before Common Era, and the burial mounds and other features that they built into the landscape to really acknowledge the celestial history that's really important to their origins, and the connections between earth, sky, and water that were very important and remain very important culturally.
It's very interesting to me to read that. We have, you know what, we have Ann in Waldo, Wisconsin, who has something for us, and I think it's pretty cool. So let's get Ann on board here. Ann, thanks for calling.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. I love your show.
Thank you. So what have you got for us today?
Well, my father went to school, UW-Madison. He was a history major. He worked for NASA for 32 years. I'm sure he observed in that observatory many times, but I got to take his ashes there and spread them off the balcony.
Oh, well, that's a new one on me. I didn't know that story.
Oh, and what was your father's name?
Ken Fensted.
Ken Fensted. Well,
what did he do for NASA? Was he an engineer or something?
No, he was a public relations officer. Ah. He wrote the releases and gave them to the press, and then he answered questions for the press on all the different missions. We lived in Florida. He worked at NASA Goddard and then NASA headquarters when he retired.
Oh, my goodness me.
Wow.
Well, that seems kind of like an appropriate place then to for his ashes to go. What do you think, Jim?
Well, that's the first I've heard of that one. That's the closest connection of many alums that I can think of. Well, interesting.
That's a great story, Ed. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that. I want to talk telescopes because they're one of the things that Washburn, everybody, they wanted to have a telescope that was at least as good as Harvard's, if I remember right.
Right. Well, so, if somebody volunteers to build you an observatory, then in those days it's how big a telescope can we get? And there were actually some early newspaper reports. There's at least one early newspaper report, which may not have been, I don't know how well informed, but they gave a number that would have made Washburn Observatory the largest telescope in the
United States
at the time. But that was very quickly changed. The story changed right away. So I don't know whether Cadwallader Washburn saw the bill or the quotation or what. But the criterion that he announced, that he's on the record as announcing, is that he wanted the observatory that the university that he was going to build from the university to be on a par with Harvard.
Yeah.
And telescope that always turns into size with telescopes because we talk about the size of the mirror or the lens. And so really that means bigger than Harvard's, which is how it's often kicked around. Ha, bigger than Harvard's. But it was not much bigger than Harvard's. Harvard had a 15-inch telescope, which they still have. And had had from the 1840s when it was one of the biggest in the world. And so the telescope that Washburn ordered from the most famous manufacturer of telescopes in that day, Alvin Clark and Sons, who were up in Massachusetts, when he asked for one that was equal or superior to Harvard's, they sent back a quotation for a 15.5-inch mirror. So that was a half inch bigger than Harvard's. It's a little more complicated than that because building a telescope like that required you to have access to pieces of glass, of optical quality glass of a certain size, and creating those was more of an art than a science in those days. And so the bigger the lens, the harder it was going to be to obtain the glass. And so I don't have the correspondence, unfortunately, but I suspect Clark said, "We've got 15.5. We can do that." And he said, "Okay, that's on a par with Harvard." It was about pretensions. I mean, it was intentions and purposes. Yeah. You know, we wanted to be a research university, and Harvard, even then, was a paragon of that kind of thing. And so that was where Washburn and Bascom. It's a statement about where they wanted this university to go.
Well, Watson. He was the first director of the Washburn Observatory, and he claimed that he had discovered the planet Vulcan, Kelly.
He sure did.
What's the story behind that?
Yeah, so Watson wasn't alone in his time. There were, for a short period anyway, there was this idea that there was a mystery planet between the sun and Mercury. Yeah. And he was certain. He was certain that he was going to find it. He built a special observatory on the hill that no longer exists today. The hill exists. The observatory does not, at least not on Observatory Hill. But he constructed this special place where he was dead set on finding Vulcan. He took special trips during solar eclipses to try and catch the mysterious planet transiting the sun. He claimed to have found it and was very quickly, as scientists are wont to do, nobody else could find it, right? So the other scientists got to work and said, sorry, Dr. Watson, but we cannot confirm your findings. They were probably less polite than that, I'd assume.
Well, there was a pretty good dispute about it that got pretty personal. Yeah, right, so Watson and one other guy thought that they had spotted it during the 1876 solar eclipse. And it was that claim that... Now, Watson was already very well known. He was director of the observatory at University of Michigan.
Yeah.
And held the world's record for discovering asteroids, which was a big deal in those days. And so people took him seriously. And when he said he had found this planet, it was a big deal. And that was... in the that was a great thing just at the time that Washburn was looking for a new director, and so we got Watson, who unfortunately Watson's tenure here was short.
Yeah,
he died just very suddenly before the observatory was even done in the fall of 1880. And so he never really got a chance to test his instrument, but his successor did, Edward Holden, who we mentioned a few minutes ago in a different context there. Edward Holden completed the instrument and tested it and determined that not that Vulcan wasn't there, but that the instrument would not work. And so that pretty much ended the career of that search here.
Well, you know, one thing that really, there were so many things that pleasantly surprised me. I learned so many things just sort of offhand reading the book. And one of them had to do with clocks. Clocks, keeping time, which I had never really thought about before. Keeping time is very important to astronomers. What kind of clocks were used by the Washburn Observatory?
Well, timekeeping actually was a traditional application for astronomers. For observatories, it was very common for observatories to be the source of accurate time. So we've all seen the time ball drop on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Well, observatories had time balls, like at Greenwich in England. There's a ball, and ships' captains could watch through a telescope, watch the time ball drop at noon, and set their chronometers before they set sail. So observatories kept that kind of time. Obviously, we didn't have any such application here in Madison, but by the time the Washburn Observatory was built, there was a demand for telegraphic time signals from the railroads.
This is what really fascinated me.
Right.
They had to know within 2 minutes or something like that?
They needed their timetable, their station masters and their conductors to have clocks, to watches and clocks that were synchronized to within a couple of minutes, because trains can collide, and there had been disastrous train collisions. So the railroads would pay significant money, as much as a few hundred dollars a year, to receive accurate time signals on a daily basis so that they can. And they did that. So the Washburn Observatory transmitted time signals over telegraph lines from the very beginning. Edward Holden set that up. And right on up through the end of the 19th century, the observatories, eventually it all got more or less taken over by the U.S. Naval Observatory. They and Western Union kind of teamed up, and they became and they undercut everybody on price. but for a while there, for about 15, 20 years, the hundreds of dollars, almost over $1,000 a year, was coming into the Washburn Observatory for that service to send out time signals. And that was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
That was enough to employ a student assistant who could then not just deal with the time service mechanisms, which are complicated, but also be helpful to the astronomers in research.
Jim Lattice and Kelly Tyrell are guests today as they talk about their book, Chasing the Stars, How the Astronomers of Observatory Hill Transformed Our Understanding of the Universe. Questions, comments, or an experience to share, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Joe Patnod, our producer today, our technical director is Jeff Robbins. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR. Great to have you along today. Larry Mueller here talking with Jim Lattice and Kelly Tyrell and their book they co-authored. It's titled Chasing the Stars, How the Astronomers of Observatory Hill Transformed Our Understanding of the Universe. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Kelly, I want to turn to you for a minute, because we haven't, I think we've mentioned men the entire time and haven't mentioned women very much. And they played a role as computers, which was another term that I hadn't heard before, individual people being called computers.
Yeah, it's a funny term to think about people as computers. It's a term that has evolved over you know, the last century, but in the late 19th century, men, predominantly men, were making observations in the night sky through telescopes and needed to record their data and transform it into useful information. We didn't have what we think of as computers today. Most of us walk around with computers in our pockets with our phones. So it really required people who could take that data, do really important calculations that were from the data coming from those observations and turn it into useful information that was then published and shared in all the ways that science today is published and shared. Mm-hmm. Observatories like Washburn, Harvard also had a strong fleet of female computers in the same era. Women were really instrumental in this kind of work. And in the book, we highlight some of those that we know about. This is history, and what survives are you know, what remains in primary materials. But you can learn more about Elizabeth Schofield and Emma Gattaker, Alice Sanborn, several other women in this era who were really important for advancing the astronomical and scientific mission of the university at the time. And I think my favorite story is about Alice Lamb, who was one of the rare women who was allowed to use the telescope and observe overnight, which was not considered a women's job at the time.
Yeah, the men got to work at night. And the women worked in the daytime for the most part, except for Alice Lamb.
Yes, Alice did do some of her own observations alongside working as a computer. And there was a couple of years after Edward Holden went to Lick Observatory, where she and her future husband, Milton Updegraff, actually kept the observatory running and actually produced the only real publishable data in that time period.
Yeah, they were grad students, if I'm not mistaken.
They were basically grad students, that's right. And so they...
Pretty smart grad students.
Well, yeah, and Updegraff made a career as an astronomer, as a naval observatory astronomer. So they were, and Alice Lamb passed up some opportunities to have a career as an astronomer. So yeah, they must have they had the task well in hand there when Holden kind of left them in charge.
Yeah,
and today women thankfully play much more prominent and active roles in astronomy.
Absolutely, and we'll get to that as well. Terry in Lake Geneva has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I was listening to you talking about timekeeping. I was a cryptographer in the Navy, and we had to sync all of our equipment every night to Fort Collins, Colorado, down to the microsecond. But what I was interested in was the size of the telescope at Yerkes, since I'm looking at it right now.
Well, the large refractor at Yerkes, they have several telescopes down there. The large refractor, the famous largest refracting telescope in the world that's there, has a lens. We always talk about the size. The lens is 40 inches in diameter. So that dwarfs the Washburn telescope, which even when it was constructed was the third largest in the U.S. after the Dearborn Observatory in Chicago and the U.S. Naval Observatory. But a few years after Washburn was completed in, we'll say, 1881, telescope actually was operational in 1879, Lick Observatory came along in the 1880s with a 36-inch telescope, and then in the 1890s, the Yerkes telescope was built by the University of Chicago, really by Charles Yerkes for the University of Chicago. So that remains the largest refracting telescope in the world, because just about that time, astronomers were recognizing the merits of reflecting telescopes, which are what all of the major research telescopes, including ours, are today.
Yeah. Terry, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go back to George Comstock, for a minute. He was the third director. I think he held that for 30 years.
That's right.
And his research was called the Older Astronomy of Precision, I think was the term used in your book.
Yeah, and that's actually Comstock's term, the Astronomy of Precision, which as his career progressed, he had to start making a distinction between the kind of research that he was doing and the new kinds of research that were growing up really quickly in the late 19th century, early 20th century, more or less what we now call astrophysics. And what that meant was that Comstock was basically making position measurements, usually of stars, by looking through the eyepiece of the telescope, looking through a, there was a special instrument called a filar micrometer.
Yeah.
And they would, this is the astronomer with his, usually his eye at the telescope basically all night, as long as the sky remains clear, making measurements, for example, of double stars. That's my favorite example, I think, because that's how they did it, was look through the eyepiece and measure the spacing and the orientation of two very, very close stars, the vast majority of which turn out to be, and this wasn't clear in those days, but because of that work, we now know that most of them are binary systems. They're actually gravitationally bound systems, and you make these, but they move very slowly. They have orbital periods of sometimes centuries, even more. So these painstaking measurements led to the understanding of star systems, which leads to, and Comstock was doing a certain amount of this, calculating, you can calculate the mass of the stars from, if you can get a good enough understanding of their orbital motions, and understanding the mass of the stars is fundamental to understanding how stars operate. What are stars?
Yeah.
That wasn't even well understood until the 1930s. That was an important scientific question. Where does the energy of stars come from? What's going on with stars? How much do they range in brightness and temperature and things like that? So getting these fundamentals comes out of those painstaking measurements that astronomers were making. Now, that kind of activity was supplanted by photography in the early 20th century, but it was still position measuring.
Yeah,
it was still maximizing the data that you could get out, get as much as you can, squeeze as much as you can out of whether it's the image at the eyepiece or the photographic plate to identify the motions of these things.
And after Comstock, it was a Joel Stebbins, I think, wasn't it?
Right,
it came the director, and he replaced that model with astrophysics.
Right. So that's just, he comes here in 1921 when George Comstock retired. In fact, Stebbins had studied with Comstock, and they were very close.
Good friends.
Friends, yeah. There's no documentation of it, but it certainly looks like Stebbins was actually Comstock's handpicked successor. Right, and Stebbins had been, though, experimenting with one of the very early tools of modern astrophysics before he came here. Basically, the electronic measuring of light, the specific technology was called photoelectric photometry, and he brought that technology here, where he really made it flourish, trained lots of people, and the use of it produced lots of really important research using that telescope up there on the hill, and that kind of photometry is a major part of the early development of astrophysics.
And I think it was around 1932 when Stebbins is quoted as saying, "We shrunk the universe."
Yeah, that's a great story, right? That's actually an eyewitness account by one of the computers reports that Stebbins walked out of the office one day and said, "We shrunk the universe." And that came directly out of that photoelectric photometry, new kinds of measurements that weren't possible without that specific technology that showed that the distances to a number of objects that surround the galaxy, called globular clusters, their distances had been overestimated. And their distribution was then used to infer the size of our galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy.
Okay.
And so the distances were wrong, and he was able to correct them using this photometry, and that produced a factor of three, depending on whose numbers you were working with, a factor of two or three reduction in the overall estimate of the size of our galaxy. Now, he's using the word universe there in kind of an old sense, before the modern concept of galaxy had actually been well defined.
Sure.
The way you would learn it today in astronomy class, they used to call the distribution of stars that we see in the sky the universe. So he had made all of that a fraction of what it had been before they did that work.
And the technology here was different. Other observatories were relying on more photographic means. Mm-hmm. It means we don't have beautiful old pictures here at the university. But instead, the work was really focused on developing these very sensitive detectors. And I think what strikes me and what stood out to me is, as I worked with Jim on this and learned more about the history, is it required Stebbins to reach out to other kinds of scientists, notably a physicist, Jacob Kunz, and really sort of combine what had been sort of an isolated field of astronomy and really start building these partnerships with physicists. And there's some connection here, too, to the very studio that we're sitting in right now, Larry. A lot of the work involved also crossed over into radio. And so there's just a lot of really interesting partnerships that are taking place during this era.
Yeah, I found that really fascinating as well. Well, we need dark skies. And actually, we should go back to that song that we started with just for a minute, because I don't want to forget it before we leave. It's a popular song. It's Dark on Observatory Hill.
Right. That was written by a UW student, or a former UW student, and was a reflected a reality on campus, which was that it's interesting, in 1929, so just as soon as the Depression happens, for some reason UW undergrad men suddenly have lots of cars. I think it must be a direct result of the Depression. I don't really know, but they drove their girlfriends up to the top of the hill, and it became a problem. It became actually sort of notorious. The UW campus was sort of notorious. There's a story about a Chicago Tribune photographer coming up here to get a few pictures of what's going on up on Observatory Hill, and there are references to it in various press. That it's mentioned when Time, I think it was Time, did an article about Joel Stebbins. That's what they led with, was what goes on up on Observatory Hill.
I can actually read. Stebbins didn't like it.
The quote is, "University of Wisconsin Jackson Jills like to go up Madison's Observatory Hill at night."
Yeah. So that that was a part of the culture which actually became a problem for the astronomers.
Yeah, because you got light.
Well, there's the light. The light is a problem. As these electronic detectors became more and more sensitive, you know, your Model A Ford ignition system was not what cars have today. They were pretty sparky and noisy. They gave off a lot of radio, and they could actually detect the cars driving by on their photometers up at the observatory. Now, in those days, Observatory Drive went right next to the observatory, so they were also way closer. So you got all these cars with couples out there in their parking in the dark, and they're right next to the observatory there. So Stebbins actually engaged in a bit of a campaign to get the hill blocked off from traffic, and it's got solved eventually later in the Depression with a CCC program to relocate. There was federal funding to pay to relocate Observatory Hill to its present distance away from the observatory now, and that was part of what was going on there.
Observatory Drive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was interesting to me. You do mention Elizabeth Waters in your book, and she, I think, won the Lewis Prize for
that's right.
a piece that she wrote.
Right along with Frederick Jackson Turner,
And just knowing my own history on Elizabeth Waters, it was interesting to me that you mentioned her in the book, and she left quite a large sum of money to the university following a very distinguished career that had really nothing much to do with astronomy.
Not that I know of.
But Liz Waters Hall, or Elizabeth Waters Hall, is built on Observatory Drive. So I thought that was a nice connection.
Right. It sort of transformed building that dormitory transformed the hill up there. The Lakeshore dorms, I think, were built in the 20s. And those were men's dorms when they were first built. And the women's dorms were over on what is now Park Street. Oh, I guess it was Park Street then, too. The women's dorms were over there. And, Liz Waters was the first big building to be built right up there next to the observatory, but it's part of that expansion of the university westward, and it also disrupted the toboggan run that used to go down Observatory Hill out onto the lake.
There's a lovely photo in the book of that.
I've got to tell you, the photos in your book are fantastic. I love looking at those old photos of the people and that toboggan run. Boy, I would love to have gone down that
yeah,
one.
Yeah. Enough to scare parents there if they think about that. But the pictures, the photos are great, and we really have to thank the people we worked with at UW Archives and the State Historical Society, who are really have great collections and are really helpful with this project.
Yeah, and there. I want to touch, we're getting closer to the end here, but I want to mention Stirling Hall. There were a number of telescopes that were moved or put on Stirling Hall. What's the background on that?
Well, so the astronomy department was outgrowing the observatory pretty rapidly in the 1950s. The university was growing. The post-war growth in higher education was enormous. And Stirling Hall predated the astronomy department's move, but in the mid-50s, they built the east wing of a new wing, the east wing of Stirling Hall, and they built a place for the astronomy department up on the sixth floor. And it was, the intention was, and what happened was, the astronomers moved out of Washburn Observatory, and they moved then one of the telescopes that used to be over at the observatory. They moved up onto the roof of Stirling Hall, and it's still there. It's the famous Burnham telescope, which is discussed in the book. But there are sites up there for fixtures up there for three telescopes.
Yeah.
So a lot of people notice those domes up on top of Stirling Hall, and not only are they still used, but one of the telescopes that used to be at Washburn Observatory is up there, and as it was before, it's still our main student telescope up there.
Well, as the sidelight that I noted in there that really struck with me was that the building, Stirling Hall, had to be restructured, or they had to have additional structures to hold the weight of the telescopes.
Right. It's normal installing telescopes to have a support that's separate from the rest of the building, that is structurally separate, so that the physical support of the telescope is not dependent on the walls, and that's partly for vibration, and partly for stability of the mounting. So there are three piers that run up through the middle of Stirling Hall to support those telescopes.
And I thought your side comment on the fact that the Stirling Hall, during the Stirling Hall bombing, which I'm sure many people are going back to the Vietnam War, that whole building might have come down were it not for those telescopes.
We like to think so. I've never heard a structural engineer say that,
Art Code claimed it.
Art Code said so.
Well, I tell you
Art
what.
I didn't know what he was talking about. Well,
I've already passed that story on in conversation with other friends, and their jaws all drop a little bit at the telling of that story. And there are so many stories that we haven't covered at all. I mean, we've spent a little more time, I think, on the front end of the observatory than the back end, which is really a fascinating part of your book.
I think how the early part of the history set up Wisconsin to be a power, to be an important part of space astronomy is a really important part of the book.
Yeah, even though the observatory is not used today scientifically, it remains an important place for public public visits and not public observation, but the science that it engendered really does have a legacy here today.
Well, you gave me many hours of enjoyment on the porch of my home. Reading this,
I'm so glad to hear that
fascinating book, and you've got, by the way, you're going to be talking. You're going to Mystery to Me tomorrow in Madison.
That's correct. Yep, 6 o'clock tomorrow.
Yeah, 6 o'clock. Check their website. Yeah.
Well, and today or tomorrow is tomorrow the official release.
Tomorrow, May 7th.
Although you can get them the books already.
Sure can.
I've heard that people are receiving them. Yes.
Jim Kelly, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
I hope you sell a lot of books. It was a fun read. Thank you. Jim Lattice is director of the UW Space Place. Kelly Tyrell, a co-author, science writer, and director of media relations and strategic communications at UW-Madison. And the book they co-authored is titled Chasing the Stars, How the Astronomers of Observatory Hill Transformed Our Understanding of the Universe. Take a look. I think you'll enjoy it. We're going to stay with the skies a little bit because we've got rocketry in mind. There's a Rockets for Schools competition that will be taking place this coming weekend in Sheboygan. And so we're going to learn more about that and about rocketry in general in our state next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.